Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Out front next, what is Trump trying to hide? The details in hundreds of redacted emails about Ukraine revealed, and they point the finger directly at the president. Plus, Bernie Sanders emboldened after raising huge money. He's going after Joe Biden like he has never before. And how did a businessman worth tens, hundreds of millions, who is about to go on trial, manage to escape Japan, just get out of the country? Was he smuggled out in a musical instrument case? Let's go out front. And good evening. I'm Erin Burnett. Out front tonight, what President Trump didn't want anyone to see, hundreds of emails now seeing the light of day. And tonight, we can read what the president and his attorney, Bill Barr, didn't want you to ever read. The website Just Security reviewing the emails, which Barr had heavily redacted. And when I say heavily, I mean heavily. I mean, look at this one. That is the two and the signature, and there's the email. The entire email message is in black. I mean, it's the same with this one. Some parts of some addresses, the entire email itself in black. And then look at this one. Same thing. It goes on and on. But now Just Security has seen what is behind this sea of black redactions. And one of the things we are learning is that a top official emailed that the decision to withhold to Ukraine, aid to Ukraine, came straight from President Donald J. Trump. Quote, clear direction from POTUS to continue to hold. And that's what was written in one of these emails. That email, in fact, was sent on August 30th, likely after Trump's own defense secretary, national security advisor, and secretary of state had personally and unsuccessfully lobbied Trump to release the aid, according to the New York Times. And this hour, the two most powerful Democrats, Senator Chuck Schumer and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, demanding they hear from witnesses after learning what's in the emails. Schumer calling the revelations a, quote, devastating blow to Senator McConnell's push to have a trial without the documents and witnesses. But as of tonight, McConnell, who is just hours from breaking his nearly 2-week silence about Trump's impeachment trial, showing no sign that he's going to budge on calling witnesses. McConnell standing by Trump, protecting the president and his men. Despite an influential member of his own party, even before news of these emails broke, said she is still open to the idea of witnesses.
I am open to witnesses.
That was Susan Collins. And Manu Raju is out front tonight live on Capitol Hill. And Manu, I know you have some new reporting on McConnell and what his plans are tonight.
Well, as Democrats are demanding those documents to be produced as part of the Senate trial, Mitch McConnell, of course, is saying he will not agree to that up front, neither documents or witnesses. That has to wait. He is making that case. And I am told that he's prepared to move forward with the agenda of the Republicans are pushing. And as the president's trial is in limbo, including pushing forward the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, as well as confirming judicial nominees, as the debate over how to move forward on the impeachment trial continues, and as Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, withholds the articles of impeachment in the House, does not send them over to the Senate. Now, I'm told that he is unlikely to go to the floor to try to begin the Senate trial if those articles are not sent over. And Nancy Pelosi saying she won't send over those articles until she understands what the Senate process is going to look like. Now, the source who is familiar with the discussions that have occurred behind the scenes says it's right at the moment, it seems doubtful that there was going to be a deal cut between Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell, which means that this partisan clash could persist for some time, which means that it could ultimately be up to Nancy Pelosi to decide when to send over those articles with impeachment if McConnell and Schumer can't cut a deal over what that trial should look like. But the big push from Democrats and the aftermath of this revelation today is to see those documents. And I just talked to one Republican Senator, Joni Ernst, who's up for re-election in Iowa, and I asked her whether or not she needs to see documents as part of the Senate trial. She sidestepped those questions. She would not answer directly. She said that she just wants to see when this trial will begin because she's planning herself a 99-county tour in Iowa. And she's calling on Pelosi to send over those articles so they can plan the trial in the Senate. And she also, Joni Ernst, would not say whether or not she wants to hear from witnesses like Mick Mulvaney and John Bolton throwing cold water on that idea, saying that was the House's job to pursue that. But nevertheless, a lot of uncertainty still on Capitol Hill about when that trial will take place as Republicans plan to move forward on other matters, including their agenda, even as the president demanding his trial to happen immediately.
All right, Manu, thank you very much. I mean, the battle lines are drawn, and this is going to be epic tonight. The chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Democratic Congressman Elliot Engel, joins me. And, you know, here's how they looked redacted. And now we're learning a bit about what's in some of these emails, including one on August 30th from a senior administration official saying the aid was withheld at the clear direction from POTUS, from the president of the United States. Okay, so that's in this email. But obviously, there were other witnesses who said as much. Is what we're learning here different? Does it move the ball?
Well, it moves the ball if you're someone who wants the truth. It doesn't move the ball if you want to cover up the truth. And that's the same pulling and tugging we've been watching now for weeks and months. Senator McConnell ought to want to pull up the shades and let this fresh air and sunshine blow in. But he's obstinate in terms of wanting to get to the truth. I think what we have heard today just corroborates everything that we've known.
So is there anything in your mind when you, I mean, the president of the United States, or his attorney general did these redact, the Department of Justice, and is there anything that would justify this kind of?
No, and I think it's an insult to Congress, and I think it's an insult to the American people.
So would it be all right at this point if Nancy Pelosi says she's never going to send over the articles of impeachment, if Mitch McConnell does what Manu Raju says he's going to do, which is continue with business as usual and refuse to entertain discussion of documents or witnesses?
Well, at some point, I think what Nancy has done is frankly been brilliant, because otherwise it would just be business as usual, no matter what was done or not done. And that's certainly not beneficial for the American people. Look, I think that Senator McConnell ought to realize that he's not a part of the defense trial, that he is a juror. And his collusion with the White House is something that should be alarming to everyone, and particularly when we're now getting all this feedback coming back, showing very clearly that the president knew about it. It was his decision to do it. And how much can you cover it up?
And, of course, as we've said, you know, the New York Times has reported, you had Pompeo, you had Bolton. They went to try to convince him to change his mind, and he refused to do so in Bedminster in August in terms of the aid itself. You did say recently, though, Chairman Engel, and I'm quoting you, I don't think we want to hold it for too long. And you were referring to the articles themselves. So this is a delicate act, right? I mean, if is it possible that Speaker Pelosi may be forced to give those articles to the Senate and not get anything in terms of witnesses?
Well, I don't think we should hold it too long for holding its sake. I mean, we should hold it until we are convinced that there can be a free and fair trial. The American people have a right to know, and these games really need to stop. I don't think holding it in itself is something that that we wanted to see, but holding it in terms of trying to get a fair trial, which the American people are entitled to see, I think she's right on the money.
So today, I don't know if you saw this, Josh Hawley, Republican senator, he tweeted, "Dem said impeachment was urgent. Now they don't want to have a trial because they have no evidence. In the real world, if prosecution doesn't proceed with case, it gets dismissed. So on Monday, I will introduce measure to dismiss this bogus impeachment for lack of prosecution." And obviously, they would need 51 votes to do so. McConnell has indicated he doesn't have those votes, but things could change. You could have people like Mitt Romney say, I don't need witnesses either, and they would have that. I mean, do you think this is a real risk that it gets dismissed?
Well, no, I think it can go to the other side as well. There's only four senators on the Republican side and needed to join with the Democrats to continue the process. And I think that's more likely to happen, because if a Republican senator knows that that he or she is very vulnerable, I don't think they're going to want to voluntarily be part of a cover-up.
So as all this has been going on, there have been some very significant international developments. When you look at what's happening in Baghdad, you look at North Korea. The president tweeted about this whole situation with the issues overseas and the impeachment. Quote, despite all of the great success that our country has had over the last 3 years, it makes it much more difficult to deal with foreign leaders when I am having to constantly defend myself against the do-nothing Democrats and their bogus impeachment scam. Bad for the USA. And now here he is. He had this relationship, he said, with Kim Jong-un, who now says he wants to expand his nuclear arsenal and his nuclear force. Another missile test could be in the offing. Is that partially the fault of impeachment?
Oh, no. The president decided that Kim Jong-un was going to be his buddy and his friend.
The love letters, as he said.
Love letters. And all we've gotten back from it is nothing. I mean, you know, the one thing, if North Korea got rid of all its nuclear weapons, it would still know how to create new ones. So that even that wouldn't be good. But at least it would show some kind of good faith on their part. And we also have our allies there, Japan and South Korea. So the president has gotten nothing out of Kim Jong-un. It's been back and it's been forth and it's been in and it's been out and nothing of concrete has happened. So I just think the whole thing is an embarrassment, and we ought to let Kim Jong-un understand that we are not going to just countenance to his nonsense.
All right. Well, I appreciate your time, Chairman Engel. Thanks so much, and good to see you tonight.
Thank you. Good to see you.
And out front next, President Trump wining and dining with his friends at Mar-a-Lago. So what are his friends telling him about the impeachment trial? Because what they say matters so much to him. Plus, Joe Biden announcing his biggest fundraising haul to date, but still trailing by millions and millions two major competitors just weeks before those crucial Iowa caucuses. And President Trump spending 1 in 5 days at his golf courses last year. Tonight, his allies respond. Tonight, awaiting a response from the White House or the Justice Department to damaging emails on Ukraine that have just been unredacted and reviewed by the website Just Security. It's these emails that I was referring to. One email shows a top budget official saying that withholding American aid to Ukraine was a, quote, clear direction from POTUS. Now, that line was redacted. It was one of these many lines put in black. Well, why? Why? Well, it was redacted by the Justice Department and the Attorney General, Bill Barr. Caitlin Collins is out front. I mean, Caitlin, look, Democrats are seizing on these new emails. There is an incredible amount of black across all of them. That, among other things that could be very important, were put in black where no one could see them. Is the White House concerned at all now about the reaction to what Bill Barr and President Trump wanted no one to see?
Well, so far, Aaron, from the people we've been speaking with, we haven't heard a lot of concern about these redactions and what the response is going to be, because we know in the past the White House has said pretty conclusively that they feel they have a lot of leeway when it comes to what they're redacting in these documents. But you're already hearing from not just Democrats, but also constitutional law experts and other experts on these matters about these redactions, about why it is that the White House, or the Trump administration rather, is redacting these documents amid this congressional oversight, this impeachment inquiry that you saw playing out over the last several months. Now, what these documents show is that there were repeated warnings from the Pentagon about the hold on this aid made pretty clearly and repeatedly to the White House. And when you read that email from Michael Duffy, that budget office aide, a political appointee, we should note, not only saying this aid is going to continue to be withheld, also that it was at the clear direction of the president and that he wanted it that way. That is really what your officials and Democrats are going to be looking at over the next several days. Now, Aaron, what's also interesting about this is that email, the same day that it was sent, the president had a meeting with the defense secretary, Mark Esper, and the secretary of state, Mike Pompeo, about the hold on that aid. And that was when it was about roughly 2 months into the hold and how long that had been going on. So what you're seeing is, just despite the fact that there were these repeated warnings from the Pentagon, that didn't change the White House's mind, more specifically the president's mind, even though we know based on other reporting from the New York Times, there were times when there were meetings with the president, Pompeo, several officials trying to convince him it's in America's best interest to release this aid. Yet the president held firm in his belief that he did not want to release that money. So it's just only going to raise new questions from here, Aaron.
All right. Thank you very much, Caitlin. Reporting, of course, from Mar-a-Lago, where the president still is on his break. Out front now, former Nixon White House counsel John Dean, congressional reporter for The Washington Post, Rachel Bade, and Joe Lockhart, who was President Clinton's press secretary during his impeachment investigation. John Dean, let me start with you. Can you think of any good reason? Let's just start with the facts here in terms of how this was handled by Attorney General Bill Barr. Any good reason for him to redact all these emails? And I just want to make it clear to people, because I'm kind of showing the ones at the top of my pile. This goes on, right, for hundreds of pages. Any good reason for Barr to do that?
Your redaction demo speaks for itself. It's way beyond the norm. And Aaron, the criteria for what can be redacted under Freedom of Information Act request is well defined. And I hope that they'll go back into court and try to press the Department of Justice on this abuse of power that we're seeing here.
Joe, what do you think? Is this what you would have tried to do, or is it clear that Bill Barr would have known this could be an abuse of power?
No, I think it shows how corrupt the Justice Department has become under Bill Barr. There's no way, on this planet that Janet Reno would have done this to protect Bill Clinton, or I think any other attorney general. So this is deep corruption. There is executive privilege, but that doesn't apply to people, in OMB talking to someone in DOD. It applies to the president and his most senior advisors. So, there is no other reason to do this except for to cover up a crime.
I mean, Rachel, you just heard the Chairman Engel saying, that he thinks this is significant. I will say you have this OMB official saying this is at the clear direction of POTUS. OK, that's damning. It does, though, corroborate what we already heard from the congressional trial, right, where there was a video conference and someone from OMB said, we're holding this up at the explicit direction of the chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, which, of course, makes it clear it came at the behest of the president. So do these emails move the ball? Does this help Democrats at all? Do you think, from your reporting, get Republicans on board with needing witnesses?
Yeah, Democrats I'm talking to on the Hill basically feel this really is going to strengthen their demand that McConnell allow certain witnesses from the White House to come forward to be summoned in the Senate trial. I mean, these documents show, again, that President Trump was very much the mastermind behind the decision to hold up this aid as they were asking for these investigations of Joe Biden in Ukraine. And not only that, the emails also show that there was a concern about the legality of what was going on. You saw top Pentagon officials saying, have you guys consulted with the lawyers on this? Are the lawyers in on this? What's going on? What's the legal justification? And it was basically told by these people were told by top OMB officials, budget officials, to keep quiet. And traditionally, Congress in the Constitution has the authority to appropriate money, and the executive is supposed to merely carry that out. This money was appropriated. And so those Pentagon officials were really concerned about the legality of this. I think this, once again, just is more evidence and more examples of a lot of further questions that Democrats want to get to the bottom of in the Senate trial. Whether or not Mitch McConnell is going to let them is a whole other issue.
I mean, John Dean, there's concern about the legality from the get-go, and it is expressed among multiple people. And then you have Bolton and Pompeo and Esper. They go to Bedminster, where the president is vacationing, and they try to get him to release this aid. They do everything they can. The Defense Department's already done all their tests and studies and said it needs to be released. Is there any doubt that the president of the United States did not know that there was a wide belief that what he was doing was illegal?
I cannot envision him not knowing. Who knows what goes in his mind and what he listens to, but he was certainly told, he was certainly informed, and it was certainly illegal. This is something that happened back during the Nixon years. They established the law then that you could not withhold spending by Congress. So it's well known publicly. I mean, I can't imagine a man would become president and not know that. So there's just no justification for this.
So, Joe, this comes as the president obviously has been at Mar-a-Lago, where we just saw Caitlin, right? He's still there. He's been there for about 2 weeks, and he has been ranting about impeachment and the Democrats. More than 60 tweets or retweets about this topic. And people that have been visiting him there, that he's been apparently spending a lot of time with, are people who have said are central to this. Rudy Giuliani on that list. And then, of course, Alan Dershowitz, who has been advising him in some sort of unofficial capacity, as well as friends in the media that he has. What does this tell you about what he's going to do, his defense strategy?
Well, it tells you that there really aren't any adults left around. I mean, I know, and I'm sure John had the same experience, that we worked pretty hard about making sure who got access to the president and who we didn't, and who didn't. And both Rudy Giuliani and Alan Dershowitz have big legal problems right now. Rudy's being investigated by SDNY. Dershowitz has been sued. He's involved in two lawsuits about sexual assault of minors. I think in any other White House, these people wouldn't be allowed anywhere near the president. But it's one of the reasons why we are where we are. The president likes people who tell him how great he is. He likes people who like to live in his glow. And he gets really bad advice.
So, Rachel, what are you hearing in terms of the bottom line here for the Senate? I mean, we played a few moments ago Susan Collins a few days ago, right, saying she's open to witnesses. You heard Chairman Engel say, well, you know, he's trying to flip the coin on this and say, well, look, we just need four Republicans on board and we could force witnesses, right, as opposed to saying that Republicans could dismiss this. Are you hearing that any Republicans in the Senate are willing to go out on a limb here, take on McConnell when they come back tomorrow and say, we want witnesses?
Well, Aaron, I think that that's still an open question, one we're probably not going to learn the answer to this week. I think you're hearing from moderate Republicans like Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, who are open to witnesses and who are obviously upset that Mitch McConnell is saying that he's coordinating with the White House. They want to be seen as objective jurors who are independent and thinking free of White House influence. But the problem is, next week, what you're going to see is all these Republicans latching on to this notion that Nancy Pelosi still has the articles of impeachment. And both moderate Republicans who have said they're potentially open to witnesses have also expressed concern about the process that the Democrats are going through. And so, you know, in a way, Democrats might be undercutting their own, you know, strongest argument for bringing witnesses forward because they're by holding the articles of impeachment in the House, they've also sort of enabled this Republican talking point that they're playing politics and trying to keep Trump from being acquitted. And so, you know, it's really going to be next week who can sort of make their point loudest. But I think the question of whether four moderate Republicans will join with Democrats, that's not going to come until after the opening statements are read and the opening arguments are made. And at that point, I think we could potentially see some. It's too early to tell.
It's just pretty fascinating because, of course, if you get to that point, as you're saying, with the opening arguments, then the articles have been handed over without there being a deal, which is just fascinating to imagine how all this is going to play out. Thanks very much to all of you. And by the way, if Mitt Romney was ever looking for a moment where it's his moment to stand up in front of the country and be the person everybody looks to, this is it. Up front next, Bernie Sanders announcing a massive fundraising haul, now going after Joe Biden. And man, this is personal and harsh. And a multimillionaire, hundreds of millions of dollars, escaping, literally escaping Japan just before his trial. Tonight, the mystery over how he did it. And there are developments, interrogations at this hour. We'll be back. New tonight, nasty. Bernie Sanders going after Joe Biden like never before. This interview was just published in The Washington Post. And in it, Sanders says, quote, it's just a lot of baggage that Joe takes into a campaign, which isn't going to create energy and excitement. He brings into this campaign a record which is just so weak that it cannot create the kind of excitement and energy that is going to be needed to defeat Donald Trump. Wow. Well, it comes after Sanders, his campaign announced today that he raised $34.5 million last quarter. It sounds huge, and it is. It is a record amount raised so far from donors this election. Jeff Zeleny is out front live. He's outside a Sanders event in Muscatine, Iowa, where Sanders has been holding several today. Jeff, look, this is as I said, I mean, it's aggressive. It's a nasty going straight at him. Sanders feeling emboldened now that he is coming right into the Iowa caucuses with all this money.
Aaron, there's no question he's feeling emboldened. And you can see behind me here, Bernie Sanders' bus is going to be driving up parking here on Main Street, Muscatine. We're just a couple blocks from the Mississippi River. Bernie Sanders is intentionally holding a bunch of smaller rallies, smaller town hall events to meet these voters one-on-one. But those words in that Washington Post interview are sharper than anything he has said to date publicly. We'll see if he repeats those words as he campaigns across Iowa. More importantly, we'll see if he puts money behind them and makes television commercials and ads. That's why this money is so important. $34.5 million. He, A, can go back to his donors again and again and again. Average contribution, some $18 or so. That's different from a lot of the other candidates. Joe Biden today also turned in a pretty impressive fundraising number, nearly $23 million, doubling his online fundraising. Money was never going to be an issue for these candidates. It shows that this race is going to go the long haul. It is going to go the distance. Bernie Sanders is in this race as long as he wants to be. He certainly is emboldened by his grassroots support. But Aaron, those words, so striking. We did not hear him say that during one of the many presidential debates. He is saving that message for right now, increasingly talking about the Iraq War, about NAFTA, other votes in Joe Biden's record. So you can feel the intensity here now, 1 month and 1 day before those Iowa caucuses. Things are going to start really escalating here in terms of the rhetoric. So far, no comment from Joe Biden. We'll see if he says anything as we're out with him tomorrow. Aaron.
All right. Thank you very much, Jeff. And I want to go now to Ested Herndon, national political reporter for The New York Times and a political analyst for us. And Abdul El-Sayed, former Democratic candidate for governor of Michigan, who supports Bernie Sanders. So, Ested, look, obviously huge money for Bernie Sanders, but I mean, you know, look, in politics, this is being nasty. I mean, he's going straight for it. He's got baggage, doesn't have energy, excitement. His record is so weak, can't create energy. I mean, wow.
Yeah, it's a direct attack from Senator Sanders. And I think it means a couple things. One, he's making that closing argument in Iowa. As we see the last month approach before votes, he's going directly at the front runner in the race, trying to hit him at areas he sees as beneficial, particularly NAFTA, as you mentioned, the Iraq War, some of the votes in Joe Biden's past. Right. But I also think it signals what Senator Sanders thinks about the rest of the field. He is looking up at Joe Biden and saying, I don't have to look behind me at Senator Warren. I don't have to look behind me at Pete Buttigieg, the former mayor of South Bend. And I think that that is an interesting window into the Sanders strategy. Buttigieg and Warren are folks who think they're strong in Iowa. What Bernie Sanders seems to be trying to do is nationalize this race and make it him versus Joe Biden.
I mean, Abdul, what's fascinating about all of this, I mean, there's many things that are fascinating about all of it, but among them, this fundraising number, is it coming from the same quarter where Bernie Sanders had a heart attack, right? Which left Sanders himself questioning what kind of campaign he would be able to run. I don't know if people remember this particular moment. Here he is.
I think we're going to change the nature of the campaign a bit. Make sure that I have the strength to do what I have to do.
I mean, he was visibly subdued after his heart scare, but things have completely changed now, Abdul. And in a campaign where age has been a discussion point for him and, of course, Joe Biden as well, is this now age and health completely a non-issue for Sanders? Is that what this money says?
Anybody who's been watching the debates knows that Senator Sanders is as vigorous as they come. He has been stumping up and down Iowa, California, all over the country. What I think is astounding, though, is the fact that this $34.5 million comes from people like teachers, people who are in the armed forces, people who are nurses, people who are the folks who we want to come out and vote. That's what I think is so critical here. What he's shown is that you don't have to go to billionaire fundraisers and ask folks to max out to you. What you can do is have a strong, solid message that brings people together. His message has always been not me, us, and that us comprises of the very folks who we need to come out and vote, who did not come out in 2016, which gave us Donald Trump, who have to come out in 2020 if Democrats are going to win. And he's closing in on that message that says that it is about what it is that you envision after Trump if you want to beat Trump.
So I said, in eschewing big donors, right, he joins Elizabeth Warren. Now, sure, she rolled out money from her Senate campaign, which had come from those sorts of donors, but that's how she has run her presidential campaign. She has not put out her numbers yet. Mm-hmm. Okay. We know she surged in the polls, right? A lot of people were saying, look, she's got it. Sanders is, you know, especially with his health, he's going to cede to her. Okay. Not only has that not happened, she has come down sharply in the polls. So how big of a threat is she to Sanders now?
It remains to be seen. I think one of the key moments is the one you're talking about, is that early October period where Senator Warren was surging in the polls, actually crossing Joe Biden in some national polls.
Yes.
And it seemed for some as if she was going to be the progressive challenger and maybe overtake Senator Sanders and his base. That's also around the time in which he suffered that heart attack. What we have seen since then has been a real reversal of fortunes. Not only has the grassroots progressive base rallied around Senator Sanders, we have seen Senator Warren take some incoming, particularly on health care and on kind of rounding out that progressive message. That was that important October debate, the CNN New York Times debate in October, where she was getting repeated questions about whether she was going to be able to pay for it. She released that plan later, but she's never recovered in the polls since that point. I think there's still a month to go. We know Iowa breaks late. By no means is anyone saying that Senator Warren is done. But what we do know is that Sanders has come out looking come out of this year looking stronger. It actually brought us back to the point that we started this year at, where it's Biden at the top and Senator Sanders looks like the top challenger.
Abdul, I mean, it's amazing because you have this, what Sanders is saying about Biden, right? Saying he doesn't have energy and excitement and he's got a weak record, right? I mean, being incredibly aggressive. We do have the Biden fundraising numbers, $23 million, his biggest fundraising quarter so far, but obviously $10 million behind Bernie Sanders. But he's still at the top of the polls. How frustrating is that to you, right? He doesn't have the same money, and certainly he spent more, so his money in the bank is even less, right? Which could be very significant. Is that going to be relevant in the polls or not?
Look, I think voters are just now starting to really take a keen look. And what we found in this race over the course of the past year, to be frank, is that folks kind of are interested in who they know about. And Joe Biden has been vice president of the United States for 8 years previous. And so people know who he is. And that's just a name ID issue. But I think when people start to look into the candidates, that's where you're going to start to see the separation. Also, the fact that the frontrunner, who's been the frontrunner for the entire past year, is raising more than $10 million less than Senator Sanders says something about the kind of surge that Senator Sanders has left in him. I also want to make a point. I thought Estead wrote a fantastic article in the Times about Medicare for All and the fact that Senator Warren's not talking about it. I love Senator Warren, but to be fair, she sort of tried to split the middle on Medicare for All. A lot of folks are trying to argue that Medicare for All is a loser. It's clearly not. And what Sanders has tried to do is zero in on it, and you're seeing the surge that's coming out of it.
All right. I appreciate both of your time very much. Thank you. And next, Pete Buttigieg, huge fundraising numbers as well, and unapologetic when it comes to who he is rubbing elbows with.
We've got to bring together all of the resources that we can.
And just how did a CEO worth $120+ million under 24-hour surveillance, possibly going to go to prison, slip out of Japan, escape and avoid trial with no one knowing about it? Did he really get in a musical instrument case? Tonight, Mayor Pete is no longer a mayor. After 8 years as the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, he is out of office. And it is not stopping his momentum, though, when it comes to his race for the White House. Abby Phillip is out front.
Pete Buttigieg kicking off the final sprint to the Iowa caucuses with a massive $24.7 million raised in the last 3 months. But some of his rivals are taking aim at how he raised that cash, with the help of wealthy, well-connected donors.
I'm not going to define my campaign by who we exclude or who we reject. This is a moment where we've got to bring together all of the resources that we can.
So far, the top-tier candidates say they've posted some of their best fundraising numbers yet. But two of the biggest fundraisers, Senator Elizabeth Warren and Senator Bernie Sanders, say they don't need the rich.
I do not sell access to my time. I don't do call time with millionaires and billionaires.
Sorry.
Sanders' campaign manager taking the fight to Buttigieg.
So if you have Pete Buttigieg, Joe Biden telling you that they need to go kowtow at the altar of the rich to fundraise for the general election, they're wrong. We are upending those notions. You can fund this totally in a grassroots way.
Warren hammering the former South Bend mayor over his fundraising, including this one recently held at an opulent wine cave.
Billionaires in wine caves should not pick the next president of the United States.
Some of the most well-connected celebrity donors and fundraisers that backed the campaigns of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama in the past are now backing Buttigieg, like actresses Gwyneth Paltrow, Mandy Moore, comedian Ellen DeGeneres, and DreamWorks co-founder Jeffrey Katzenberg. actor Kevin Costner even campaigning recently in Iowa.
I see Pete as a man of his moment.
Buttigieg arguing that every dollar available should be used to beat Donald Trump in 2016.
What I'm saying is that we can't go into this fight against Donald Trump with one hand tied behind our back.
Other Democrats say it's time to change the way campaigns are funded. They point to emails like this one from a Buttigieg fundraiser obtained by Axios. The fundraiser H.K. Park writing, "If you want to get on the campaign's radar now before he's flooded with donations after winning Iowa and New Hampshire, you can use the link below for donations." A Buttigieg campaign spokesman said the campaign did not authorize the language, but called it ridiculous to read the pitch as anything more than asking potential supporters who may be interested in Pete to join our campaign before caucusing and voting begins. Buttigieg firing back at his critics.
According to Forbes magazine, I am literally the only person on this stage who's not a millionaire or a billionaire.
Now, Aaron, out here on the campaign trail, we typically hear this issue of campaign donations and where they come from younger voters. But Pete Buttigieg's supporters tend to be a little bit older, which could explain why there are no signs that there is going to be any slowdown in these types of fundraisers, particularly as we are just a few weeks away from the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary. Aaron.
All right. Thank you very much, Abby. And next, authorities now questioning pilots in connection with Carlos Ghosn's escape from Japan. New pictures emerging of the powerful businessman partying on New Year's Eve while on the run. Plus, Jeannie Mose on Amy Klobuchar calling out Trump for breaking a key promise.
There won't be time to go golfing all the time.
New tonight, pilots held for questioning. Pilots suspected of helping Carlos Ghosn escape are being detained in Turkey. And on French TV tonight, a photo of the fugitive partying on New Year's Eve in Beirut appeared there with his wife and friends, wine, having a grand old time. After he fled, he escaped house arrest in Japan. Ghosn, the former head of Nissan, Mitsubishi and Renault, was under 24-hour surveillance without a passport. No passport. Somehow, though, he managed to escape Japan, fly around the world with stops, and is now flaunting his escape. It is an incredible tale, and Tom Foreman is out front.
This kind of opportunities.
How can Ghosn be gone? That is the mystery rocking the world as investigators dig through the house where Japan supposedly had the country's most famous accused man under strict surveillance. The multimillionaire fugitive allegedly slipped out of that house and out of Japan right under their eyes, flying into Turkey and on to Lebanon, where he issued a defiant statement. "I have not fled justice. I have escaped injustice and political persecution." Ghosn was the visionary leader of Nissan and Mitsubishi. Then he was charged with massive financial crimes, which he's denied. His three passports were taken. His use of phones and computers was heavily restricted. International travel was forbidden. And Japan's immigration system is state of the art. So how did he vanish? The speculation, like Ghosn, is running wild. Lebanese reports say he was smuggled out in a huge musical instrument case, like the kind for a double bass, following a private performance by an ensemble at his home. Reuters and the Financial Times say he was whisked away by a private security firm. Indeed, a flight tracking company did spot a private plane hopping along his alleged escape route. And authorities in Turkey have detained airport workers, including several pilots. Japanese media say he used a spare French passport to escape. French officials say they don't like to get involved in such matters, but also they won't extradite him if he shows up there. Bottom line?
Armed with the motivation to escape and backed by personal fortune, even the most high-profile suspect can evade justice by paying the right people.
There is speculation that Ghosn's wife plotted his escape for months, but he says no. "I alone arranged for my departure. My family had no role whatsoever." However, he slipped away. For now, Ghosn is now believed to be in this house in Lebanon, where authorities say they won't extradite him either. That is, if he's really there at all.
This is a huge embarrassment for Japan, of course, and it could get worse. Ghosn said all along that he's not only innocent, but that he's the target of a corrupt government plot to not just take his freedom, but also his money. And we're probably going to hear more of that now that he no longer seems to have a trial on his agenda this year. Aaron?
All right. Thank you very much, Tom. And I want to go now to former CIA operative Bob Baer. I mean, Bob, this is an incredible story. When you're talking, you know, as Tom said, Japan's immigration system is state-of-the-art. He's under 24-hour surveillance. He has no passports. They're monitoring every single one of his phone calls. No one can come and go without their say-so. I mean, how do you think he escaped?
Oh, Aaron, I think it's pretty clear he came out in a box of some sort, out of the house, through Osaka Airport. I've done this enough that that's the only way to really get somebody out. You don't send them through immigration, through any airport. You don't risk an, you know, alias passport. This man is well-known in Japan. No way. You have to conceal him first in the car and then a box, put him on a private plane, send him as cargo, let him get out of the box once he's in the airplane and it's on the air, and then just move him to Lebanon. It's very easy to get into Lebanon. I think that's the only plausible explanation.
And it's pretty incredible. You look at, you know, a double base case is about 6 feet. He is just shy of 5'6", so he could get in there and have a little room. You got a couple holes in it. I mean, I could. It's incredible, but I suppose you could see it happening. I mean, one question for you, though, Bob, is if this is, say, Israel instead of Japan that had been wronged, they would get him back, right? Somebody would pose as something to get him back, right? You know, kind of it take as much time as it took to infiltrate him, get him to trust them, and then get him back.
Yeah, the Japanese are never going to do it. They can't operate in Lebanon. They're not going to kidnap him. They're just absolutely astounded that this even happened, that someone could get away with it. But, you know, I think going back to somebody professional did this, knew what they were doing, practiced, knew the Japanese system, and got him out on a private plane. And the CIA's done it enough, so's the KGB. You can do it if you know what you're doing.
And obviously, we still need to know who arranged for it and who those ex-special forces, as is reported, possibly were, who executed it, from which country. Thank you so very much, Bob. And next, Jeannie Mose on the attack that is sure to tee off Trump. Tonight, Amy Klobuchar takes on Trump for golfing, and then things got nasty. Here's Jeannie.
Through the waving palms, he appears, the familiar presidential silhouette glimpsed through a gap in the shrubbery. It's Donald Trump on vacation, or perhaps Donald Trump working. Either way, it's par for the course that he's on his own golf course, even if, as a candidate, he proclaimed,
there won't be time to go golfing all the time.
Because I'm going to be working for you. I'm not going to have time to go play golf.
I just want to stay in the White House and work my ass off.
Yeah, well, he's also working on his swing. Remember how he used to bash President Obama?
He played more golf last year than Tiger Woods.
Golf, 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 more, more.
But guess who does it more, more, more often? Trump spent one of every 5 days in 2019 at a golf club, inspiring Democratic presidential candidate Amy Klobuchar to tweet, "For the record, I spent 0 days on the golf course in 2019. Trump supporters used a comb rather than a club to clobber Klobuchar. For the record, I've eaten zero salads with a comb. A dig at Klobuchar for getting mad at an aide who misplaced her fork on a plane, prompting her to use a comb to eat her salad. But back to the greens you golf on.
Look at that.
Pity the poor photographer whose duty it is to capture images of the president golfing. It's a cat-and-mouse game that the White House doesn't really want us to see.
It's like going fishing, and if you don't catch a fish, you know, it's not as exciting, right?
But CNN photojournalist Khalil Abdallah caught the big one the other day while Trump was playing at his West Palm Beach course. Back in the early days, they even used a box truck to block the view. And once,
a few extra trees appeared magically.
New trees were actually planted as a barrier to a photographer. Capturing the number one guy through a hole is like a hole in one. Jeannie Mose, CNN, New York.
He's not going to like that video. Thanks for joining us. Anderson starts now.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.